content for this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the ideas section of the magazine. It is entitled, The Violent Fantasy Behind the Texas Governor's Pardon Demand. A grant of clemency would encourage those who dream about someday engaging in murderous political violence. This was written by Adam Serwer and is from April of 2023. In July 2020, at the height of the protests over the murder of George Floyd by a police officer, Daniel Perry considered killing someone. I might have to kill a few people on my way to work. They are rioting outside my apartment complex. Perry, then a 35-year-old Army sergeant, wrote to a friend, the Austin Chronicle reported. It wasn't the first time Perry had spoken about killing people on social media or in messages with friends. On another occasion, Perry mused, I might go to Dallas to shoot looters. After all this talk, Perry did shoot a Black Lives Matter protester in downtown Austin. An Air Force veteran and libertarian activist named Garrett Foster, who had been legally carrying an AK-47 at the protest. Perry, who was working as a rideshare driver, sped his car into the crowd, witnesses said, then opened fire on Foster. Perry claimed that he had acted in self-defense and that Foster had been raising his rifle. But prosecutorial witnesses told the jury during his trial that Foster had done nothing of the sort. I believe he was going to aim at me, Perry told police in an initial interview, having called law enforcement and turned himself in after the shooting. I didn't want to give him a chance to aim at me. Thursday night, the judge in Perry's case unsealed a filing that also contained messages the jury did not see before the verdict. The document showed Perry sharing racist memes, referring to black protesters as monkeys, and musing about hunting Muslims in Europe. Perry's attorneys are reportedly seeking a new trial. Perry had lived out his fantasy. There was only one problem. His public and private expressions of violent aggression toward protesters and his decision to drive his car into the crowd led a Texas jury to conclude that the shooting was unjustified. The state's Stand Your Ground law does not allow those who provoke a confrontation with the aim of using lethal violence to justify their actions as self-defense. Proving the intent sets a deliberately high standard for prosecutors because it requires strong evidence of what the accused is thinking. Yet, the prosecutors in this case managed to do so in a very gun-friendly state, as the journalist Radley Balco writes, because of ample evidence that Perry intended to harm the protesters, including testimony that Perry had asked a friend about the legality of other incidents in which someone had shot at protesters. The documentation of ill intent here is unusually comprehensive. Convicted of murder, Perry became a right-wing political martyr. Last weekend, Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott announced that he would ask the Texas Parole Board to recommend a pardon for Perry, following coverage from the Fox News host Tucker Carlson portraying his conviction as unjust and criticizing Abbott. Carlson characterized Perry's conviction by a jury of his peers in one of the most pro-gun states in the union, not as a result of the atypical volume of evidence, but as a conspiracy by the liberal billionaire George Soros, who, quote, paid people to put his political opponents in jail. Fox News has a disproportionate influence over only the only constituency Abbott heeds, which is Republican primary voters. At the center of this series of events is the right-wing fantasy of murdering political opponents and getting away with it, one that the firearm industry has used to sell weapons and that ambitious right-wing politicians have used to win votes. Put simply, some conservatives believe that Perry's conviction was unjust because they do not believe that it should be a crime to kill a Black Lives Matter rioter, a description that in the right-wing imagination applies to any and all BLM protesters, regardless of their actions. There are a number of factors involved in the popularity of this fantasy, including urban-rural polarization and the GOP's decision to press its advantage in an American electoral system that rewards the dispersed geography of its political coalition. This approach demands that Republicans' leaders feed their supporters a constant diet of culture war red meat in order to maintain a sense that their constituents' way of life is in danger of imminent destruction. Such catastrophism has both inspired and been inspired by a shift in how the firearms industry sells weapons. Since the expiration of the federal assault weapons ban in 2004, the firearm industry has juiced its sales by inundating conservatives with advertising that promotes guns as a cure for compromised masculinity and implies that they need to stockpile firearms for an inevitable political conflict in which they will finally get to kill people they don't like. That's partly how we ended up with the haggard pop star so unnerved by an inclusive corporate ad campaign that he shoots at beer cans to self-soothe, a tough guy literally triggered by rainbows. Gun sales have risen dramatically over the past few years. Those sales have only confirmed the industry's strategy for achieving growth, and so the marketing effort has become only more addicted to conspiracy theory-fueled political partisanship. Ryan Buse, a former firearms industry executive, wrote in The Atlantic in 2022, America is seeing the deadly results of the violence incubated by these dark advertising fantasies. One might question how often guns are actually used in self-defense, but marketing guns for self-defense or hunting at least has no inherent partisan salience. And America has a long cultural and legal tradition of firearm ownership for such purposes. Perhaps the crucial difference here is the shift from the individual to collective self-defense. Instead of just selling the possibility of defending your home from a nighttime intruder, the industry and its allies are now selling the idea that buying a gun turns you into a soldier defending civilization itself from the barbarian hordes. You know, people who disagree with them politically. In this worldview, violence against such people is by definition self-defense, regardless of the specific circumstances. The people who have adopted this political and consumer identity will not necessarily act out violently. In fact, the overwhelming majority of them will not. In a country with more than 300 million, with lax gun laws, some small number will act out on these beliefs to bloody and tragic results. But those who embrace such an identity will be more willing to rationalize, excuse, or defend political violence against their opponents when it does happen. They will also be more open to the illiberal use of state force against those they see as foes in an existential battle. Advertising guns for an imminent political conflict has reshaped American gun culture, enlarging a voting constituency that opposes all firearm restrictions, in part because its members dream about someday engaging in murderous political violence. This faction also demands that politicians shape the law so that they can do so with impunity. That political pressure was bearing down on Abbott when he made the decision to request that the pardon board grant clemency to Perry. The injustice is that Perry was convicted of murder for killing someone who deserved to die because he was supporting a left-wing cause. The legal system built by decades of Republican dominance in Texas was meant to justify such killings, and when it failed to do so, the governor had to intervene. Facing prison time for shooting a political enemy would spoil the reverie sold to conservatives by their leaders and by the firearm industry. The promise that one day they too could kill one of the barbarian horde and get away with it. And that would be unjust. Our second article is from the September 2022 Family section of the Atlantic magazine and is entitled American Family Policy is Holding Schools Back. A child's ability to succeed in the classroom is powerfully influenced by their home environment. Giving parents the support they need could be key to fixing American education. By Stephanie H. Murray. Many American schools are failing to provide all students with a quality education, and policymakers don't seem to know what to do about it. Even before schools closed during the pandemic, 30% of graduating seniors failed to reach a basic level of competency in reading, and 40% failed to do so in math, according to national data. Performance gaps across race and socioeconomic status in both subjects have persisted to some degree for decades. Meanwhile, teachers are amongst the most stressed out workers in America. And though concerns about educators leaving in droves have yet to materialize, the number of young people entering the profession has been dwindling for years. Over the past two decades, government officials have made various attempts to improve the state of American education, ramping up standardized testing, expanding charter schools, and urging states to adopt uniform benchmarks for student achievement. To little avail. Perhaps understandably, these efforts have mostly fixated on what takes place within the halls of America's K-12 public schools. But less attention has been given to another profound influence on our educational system, our nation's family policy. My reporting suggests that many of the elements fostering children's academic success have roots outside of school, and that if America wants to help teachers, it will have to do a better job of supporting parents. The United States is a difficult place to raise a child. Paid leave and affordable child care, common benefits in many of our peer countries, are not guaranteed. Available support, such as tax credits or unpaid job-protected family and medical leave, sometimes exclude the poorest citizens. Many aids targeted specifically at needy families can be very difficult to access or come with employment requirements, a big ask in a country with little infrastructure to back working parents. These conditions not only make life unnecessarily difficult for caregivers, they also compromise the entire project of teaching America's kids. A child's education begins the moment they are born. Dana Susskind, a founder and co-director of the TMW Center for Early Learning Plus Public Health at the University of Chicago, and the author of Parent Nation, told me, "The majority of physical brain development occurs within the first few years of life before most children ever step into a classroom. This is a sensitive time when kids are both particularly vulnerable to stress and well primed to gain cognitive ground. Parents play a major role during this stage as children's first and most important brain architects," Susskind said. "Engaging kids in rich interactions, tuning into what interests them, talking and reading to them, and letting them talk back, helps stimulate and strengthen the neural connection that builds brain power and lay the foundation for learning. Many parents, such as those without paid leave or with punishing work schedules, have fewer opportunities to devote such attention to their children. Wealthier families can outsource the labor to professionals, but as the country grapples with a massive shortage of child care workers, more parents and kids are on their own. When children don't get early support, their ability to learn suffers. According to Susskind, the nurturing back and forth between caregiver and child is linked to achievement in literacy, math, spatial reasoning, and self-regulation, all of which are crucial to academic success. Without sufficient engagement, children risk entering school already behind. One estimate from 2017-2018 school year, half of American 3 to 5-year-olds aren't on track in at least one area of scholastic readiness, such as math and expressive language, or emotional development and behavioral management. Asking teachers to try to make up the difference is basically impossible, Susskind said. Policymakers often point to universal pre-K as a potential solution, but although that could certainly help, it doesn't start early enough. As young as 9 months old, low-income children score worse on cognitive development tests than their wealthier peers, and the disparity widens as they enter toddlerhood. The trouble may begin in early childhood, but the strain on American parents can continue to create issues once children start school. As caregivers, parents are expected to do a lot to support their children's education, drop them off and pick them up, buy supplies, attend meetings with teachers, manage the logistics of extracurriculars and sports, help with homework. And if a child has a learning difficulty related to their health, such as trouble with their eyesight or hearing or a developmental disorder, parents are responsible for making and taking them to appointments and sometimes even implementing strategies learned in therapy at home. This high level of involvement in a child's education is a powerful predictor of academic success, but it's very difficult for many to undertake. If you're not able to either predict your work schedule or get time off from your job to do these kinds of things, that kind of wipes out your ability to be so engaged, Jennifer Lansford, director of the Center of Child and Family Policy at Duke University, told me. For low-income parents, the challenges can be more extreme. Children cannot learn effectively when their basic needs, food, shelter, sleep, safety, are unmet. Stress at home can lead to misbehavior in class and cycles of learning disruption. Lindsay Popilskis, a psychologist at Clarkstown Central School District in New York, told me, "When children act out, they miss class time, fall behind, and become frustrated, so they act out again," Popilskis said. Although teachers employ a variety of strategies to manage classroom disruptions, with some success, they can only do so much if they can't address the source of the problem. Suzanne Langolis, who has spent the past 17 years teaching at a public high school in a wealthy part of Maine, has no doubt that the resources among her students' families make her job easier. She told me that she rarely sees the behavioral issues that she used to when she worked in a district with a much higher level of poverty. She finds it much easier to engage teens who aren't distracted by concerns about their family's health or employment. Having grown up with so much support, her current students are generally more confident learners. They still have problems, as all kids do, but those tend to be less pressing and easier for her to address. "It's amazing how much more I get to actually teach," Langolis told me. "When I was in my previous district, I always felt like I had so many kids who had needs, and I wasn't meeting any of them. It felt terrible. Now, with fewer kids in crisis, she has the bandwidth to check in with anyone who is having a hard time. I get to feel more successful, and that brings more energy to the teaching." Schools can be a lifeline and haven, especially for those with difficult home lives. Right now, we are and have been the unacknowledged social safety net for America, Theo Morardi, a teacher in Seattle, told me. Schools not only provide food, care, and vaccines, but also connect families with various community aids or assist them as they navigate the labyrinthine process for obtaining Medicaid, housing, and other services. But this is a lot of responsibility to put on one institution. And ultimately, a child's ability to succeed in the classroom is strongly influenced by the level of support they receive at home. Addressing the forces holding back American education is not possible without assisting America's families. Leaving it to the schools to play catch-up is unfair to teachers and parents alike. Our third article is entitled, "We've Been Measuring the Economy All Wrong," by Annie Lowry. The Trump administration made some bold claims about the 2017 Tax Cuts and Job Act, which slashed the corporate tax rate. Larry Kudlow, head of the former president's National Economic Council, said it would boost GDP so much that it would virtually pay for itself. Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, went further, saying the tax cut would, in fact, create additional revenue. This was fantastical nonsense. Tax cuts rarely, if ever, pay for themselves. But the Congressional Budget Office gave the Trump team sales pitch one important boost. The agency ran the bill through its model and concluded that it would have a positive, if muted, effect on long-term growth. Most Republicans were going to support Trump's bill no matter what, but now they could do so with a straight face. The CBO's relatively sober prediction was wrong, a group of respected economists is charging. The budget office, along with other forecasters, assumes that when corporations get a tax cut, they take some of that money and reinvest it in their business, boosting growth and productivity. That assumption ignores a central dynamic of today's economy. Many sectors are dominated by a small number of huge companies. Much has been written over the past few years about the rise of corporate concentration. The Biden administration has made fighting monopolies one of its key economic policy priorities, yet none of the leading economic models takes consolidation into account. This is more than a purely technical concern. The risk is that conventional modeling is misinforming policymakers, Republican and Democratic alike, on how to structure policies that affect everyone. Governments may be relying on models that are too stuck in theory, too slow changing, and too simplistic to be truly helpful. The existing models do not work well, particularly in the moments when it really counts, such as a financial crisis, Joseph Stiglitz, former chief economist for the World Bank, told me. The underlying economics, the assumptions that go into the economics, are very badly flawed. Stiglitz is an advisor to American University's new Institute for Macroeconomic and Policy Analysis, an initiative to update those assumptions and improve those forecasting tools. Today, IMPA is launching a new economic forecasting model that researchers believe better captures how the economy works and, by extension, how policy changes will really play out. Competitive economies and monopolized economies behave very differently, economists have found. When there's plenty of competition, corporations tend to plow money into their businesses, investing more in research and development or raising worker pay to attract talent. But if a company doesn't face much real competition, the pressure is off. It can simply pass the extra money along to shareholders. A model that ignores this distinction might be suitable for a tidy theoretical economy, but it won't match the messy one we live in. In the inaugural paper using IMPA's model, the economists Lydia Brun, Ignacio Gonzalez, and Juan Montesino concluded that the Trump tax bill was, quote, harmful to the economy. It slowed down growth and amped up inequality. Slashing the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21% did not boost workers' wages by thousands of dollars a year, as Trump appointees had predicted, nor will it boost GDP in the long term. The IMPA model finds instead that cutting the corporate tax rate reduced the funds used for productive investment by shunting money into investor payouts. What's more, it suggests that raising taxes on business monopolies might stimulate growth by lowering this firm's stock market returns and thus spurring investors to pour money into more dynamic businesses. The relationship between corporate tax rates and business investment is a fiercely debated topic among economists, and some forecasters I spoke with didn't think that rising corporate concentration was causing them to overestimate the economy's growth. Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's Analytics, who did not work on the IMPA project, told me that concentration shows up indirectly in other variables commonly included in big forecasting models. That said, several forecasters agreed that conventional models rely on questionable, even laughable assumptions. Some models, for instance, assume that the country has perfectly competitive labor markets in which workers have total freedom to switch jobs and are paid precisely what they're worth to the company's bottom line. And the models generally don't account for the ways in which markets dominated by so few competitors, Google with web search, Amazon with online shopping, might skew profits, investments, and wages. The assumption that there's no market power is just wrong, Stiglitz told me. It's so obvious. In many sectors of our economy, we don't have anything that approaches that level of competition. He cited the tech sector, drug stores, even dog food. Creating the new IMPA model to account for monopoly power in the United States was a three-part process, Montesino and Gonzalez told me. The researchers first constructed a complex mathematical model capturing a variety of factors that contribute to growth. They then tested it against historical data, seeing how well it would predict the 2015 economy using financial numbers from 2012, for instance. Finally, they let other economists critique it and review its predictions. One of those economists was Kimberly Clausing, a tax expert at UCLA School of Law. She said that she appreciated the attempt to make a model that accounted for enormous companies' outsized power. Things look different when things get hyper-concentrated, she told me. Look at the economy of the 1970s, when there was less concentration. The labor share of income was higher. Investment was higher. So many of the main macro variables performed differently. Many of the forecasters I spoke with mentioned that forecasting is just plain hard. And sometimes economists have not gotten much better at it in recent decades. Chris Vivares of S&P Global Market Intelligence, a forecaster with decades of experience who is not affiliated with the IMPA, noted that the economy is enormous and complex, impossible to predict events such as the coronavirus pandemic and the war in Ukraine happen all the time. Even the world's most influential economists often disagree on what causes what. There's not always good data, he told me. That's just something we have to live with. That said, IMPA's economists stressed that rising corporate concentration has profoundly changed our economy over the past several decades. It seems past time for it to also change how we model the economy. As I complete today's third article, I'm recognizing that this set of stories has been rather bleak. I will strive to bring you a wider variety of topics in future episodes. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you're enjoying it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a wonderful day.